If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You already love the Mixing Music podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me, as always, is Logic Lou.
It's actually Logicless.
Logicless Lou.
Yeah, I don't know.
Void of logic.
Yeah, sometimes that's just the vibe I'm on.
Nice, I love it. So are we all. Some of us, we're just running purely on adrenaline and emotion.
Nah, I was going to say caffeine, but...
Okay, fine, yeah. Caffeine. Well, anyway, we are today. We actually were supposed to record about an hour ago, and then we just started talking about other different things, and we were just hanging out as friends. And that's, yeah. You know, that's the sweet thing about us as hosts is that Lou and I, at the end of the day, we're actually friends.
Yeah. No, honestly.
We're not just pretending to be.
Yeah. We may sound strained and tired. Maybe it's because we do these things in the morning sometimes, but if you were to hear the post-show stuff, I don't know, maybe that's a thing. Maybe that's a thing.
Surprise, but, we are strained and tired.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you can see me now on the video, if you're watching on YouTube, my hair is very disheveled, and I'm seeing some dry spots. I need to lotion my face. But hey, listen, man, I'm just saying, it's the morning. It's Monday after a long weekend of doing some shows and events, but we have good conversations before and after the show, and then when we do the cuts, you know, we out here talking about the real things that you guys want to hear about.
That's right. And so today we're talking about minimalist mixing.
Ooh.
Doing more with fewer plugins. I don't really... Okay. Off the top of my head, I think the reason why you want to do more with less is I think one is just the practical reason of just offloading processing from the computer.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you have like a slower computer that it keeps crashing on you, bugging out on you. It just won't play back the audio if you have too many plugins on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might want to use less, right? But also, I'm thinking more of like in a philosophical way. I do think one, like this is becoming a lot more prevalent and a lot more in the limelight, spotlit culturally as people are opening up about it. Mm-hmm. I do think one of the biggest issues when it comes to mixing among beginners and intermediates is doing too much.
Yeah.
More importantly, not realizing when you're doing too much, which usually comes down to the fact that people are usually overcompensating by correlating good with effort.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. When a child says that they like music, it's usually effortless. There's not much thought. The reasons are given in retrospect after you've been asked, why do you like the music? Usually people are like, I like the song, or I don't. And then you have to give reasons afterwards. Same thing with mixing. Like, I think usually, if you are good enough that you don't have to overcomplicate your decisions, I think it's all about mixing is all about coming back to that childlike, spontaneous, emotional connection to the music.
Yep.
Through plugins, right? And we've talked about this, like the plateau of realization, the trough of disillusionment. Or like, what is that? The valley of technicality. That's what I usually call it. Based off of the Gartner hype cycle principles. Anyway, Yeah, so that's kind of what it comes down to. Like, at the end of the day, the most advanced mixers kind of revert back to this childlike connection, emotional connection to the music.
Yeah.
They're so well-versed with their technical tools, with the understanding of audio in itself from, like, a physics level, but also from a technical, just practical level of using plugins and how they work on the computer.
Yeah.
We're going to approach it from two different ways.
Yeah, one of the funny things is, like, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people that at a certain point, they get to a point where they're like, you know what, dialing things back just kind of starts to feel better. And I feel like there's people who want to classify themselves as like purist or, you know, like saying like, hey, listen, man, the closer you get it to the original recording, the better it sounds. And in some cases, that's true. You know, like some people did a really good job at recording something, and adding too much processing does kind of take away from the sound of things. For instance, like if you have a really well recorded vocal and you're doing one of those things where you add 30 points on Pro Q3 to do like resonance cutting and all that, you start to find out, hey, some of that resonance was kind of part of the vibe.
Yeah.
And you're kind of taken away from it by doing way too much. Like, you might have just needed 4 or 5 points at most, you know?
Dude, and, on the opposite end, mm-hmm. 4 out of 5 times, if you have 30 points on Pro Q3, you're probably doing too much. But you also have to be open-minded enough to realize that if it sounds good, it sounds good. Yeah. So it's like, it's the paradox and the ambiguity of like being open to listening to what sounds good.
Yeah. So I had somebody show me what they were doing once on a reverb that I thought was just a little bit weird, but I landed there, which was they took all the notes that weren't in a key out of Pro Q3. So we're talking like 30, 40 points on the EQ, right? And they just highlighted all of them and they took the notes that weren't in the key of the song and took them down by about 3 dB to put the reverb essentially into key. And I was like, I don't know. That sounds weird. But then when I heard it in practice, I was like, you know what? Maybe this is contextual. Maybe I haven't tried it. And because of that, this feels weird. But it sounded pretty good. But no way in hell am I actually trying that, let's say, live or something. Because in live, there's actually kind of this known thing where I was talking about this with a friend of ours named Jonah, where he proposed a situation. I wouldn't call it a situation, but he was trying to find a solution for what the client wanted, which was bringing their studio sound, their vocal chain that they use in studios, you know, live. And their studio chain was pretty simple. It was PSE from Waves, which is kind of like a source enhancer, you know, minimizing feedback and things of that nature, like expanding how far you can get in the dynamic range without causing feedback issues. Not sure why that was in a studio chain, but maybe they just added that in post for live to help it translate. They had like Pro Q4 or Pro Q3, one of the Pro Qs, and then they had like 3 de-essers.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, how much sibilance do you have? And no, it was 4 de-essers, one at like 4K, one at 6K, one at like 9K, and another one at like 10 or something like that. And I was like, damn, all this when you could have just done multiband. Like, you really could have isolated those ranges with like Pro Q4 or something, or, you know, something of that nature. Like, I feel like you could have done less processing and resulted in the same thing. But when you heard it, it sounded pretty good. But the main concern that I had going in without looking at the chain is a lot of times when you do live work, like let's say you're adding 4 compressors, like the 1176 into the LA-2A thing, or you're doing like a CL-1B emulation into an RVox into like an SSL channel, and then the SSL channel has its dynamics engaged. In studio, certain things work, but over-processing like that in live could result in feedback. You know, it could be the reason that the noise floor goes up and then you can't really get the mix to sound as loud because, yes, people want concerts to be loud, not too loud, but they want to hear slamming kicks and snares and 808s in the stadium. That's something they want. But it's very different there, where you could essentially create limitless headroom by adding more speakers to the system, which means you don't need as many clippers or compressors to get the kick drum to sound loud. In fact, an uncompressed kick drum sometimes sounds really nice on a big system, which I think is kind of the reason that a lot of people like Augsburgers in the studios when they're cooking up, they don't want to worry about compression. They just want it to be loud at that moment.
Yeah.
But for that same reason, you start overprocessing this desired just looseness, right? Like they just love that it's dynamic. They like that the kick sounds punchy. They like that the snare is ringing right through the speaker system. But then you start adding too much compression, too much clipping and things like that. And it just kind of sucks the life out of it sometimes. And then you end up having to dial it back because the client says, hey, I feel like something's missing. And that's where you start landing in the realm of overprocessing, over EQing and things of that nature. You start sucking out the wrong things. And the wrong thing sometimes, the wrong thing to suck out is sometimes what's wrong with the record. Sometimes what's wrong with the record actually is what's right with the record. A good example of this, to give you your flowers, DK, is King Baby. I think King Baby was really noisy at first listen. And the first time I listened to it was at Atlantic when we were doing the KSD monitor listen.
Context, the song is King Baby by Carol's Daughter, and I mixed it.
Yeah. Hence why we're giving DK his flowers on it. But when I was listening to him, like, okay, it's kind of grainy. It's kind of mid-rangey. It's kind of all of these things, right? But if you were to take it away, it just wouldn't feel right. Because I don't think the artist ever intended it to feel necessarily right. And if you listen to the context of the record, it's not supposed to sound right. Like, listen to the lyrics, listen to what's going on, how it's performed and everything. And you would realize that grainy is good. Dirty is great.
It's definitely not that Lou in his mind has already decided that I'm a great mixer, so he's just excusing my inadequacies as, oh, this must be unintentional and done.
No, but it's cool because, like, I think most people that are starting out would hear what's, I guess you could say, traditionally wrong with it. Or I guess you could say in an era where everything is so clean and pristine and round and intentionally clipped a certain way, but still somehow clean. They might listen to it and be like, oh, that's a little too mid-rangey. That's a little too this, a little too that. But then you get to the chorus and you're just like, bam, 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 bam. And you're like, no, hold on. We got to the core of the vibe. If you clean that part up too much, it would just suck. And that's where like overprocessing sometimes kind of takes its turn. Sometimes the suck is what's good.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And I think this is really difficult to, because there is some practicality.
Sometimes overprocessing gives you the good.
Or that too, but I'm also thinking like, there's something practical about like having your way of doing things and sticking to that way of doing things and being less open-minded to emotional. And then there's obviously good things and bad things to being open-minded. Like it's difficult to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're taking bigger risks, right?
Yeah.
So number one, to kind of put this into like talking points and bullet points, like the problem with plug-in hoardings, hold on, let me preface this section here. The rest of this entire podcast is going to come off as like common sense to a lot of people. So take this episode as like gentle reminders of things that we tend to forget about when we get too deep into the weeds.
Yeah.
We get too deep into the weeds and we're looking at it too microscopic and then we forget to look back from like a macro lens. So this is just a helpful reminder episode. So forgive us if everything sounds a little bit too common sense and duh. But the problem with plug-in hoarding is that more tools don't mean better sounds. And I already talked about this. It's like, don't correlate effort and more tools to making what you're getting paid like for value. Like people aren't paying you that amount of money because you have a lot of tools or because you're using more tools. Like it's not about the time you spend. People aren't paying you for your time if you're charging per project, right? It's not about the time. And even if you aren't charging per hour, it's not really about the hours. Anyway, number two, decision fatigue slows creativity. Like when you have a lot of tools and you're trying to do a lot, like that slows down creativity. It's like the famous quote of like creativity thrives on limitations, not infinite options. I forgot who it's by. You can look it up afterwards.
Yeah.
Or like the illusion of control, thinking you need that exact 1176 clone when the stock one works fine. Like you need this exact 1176. That's like the illusion of control. Like it's not real control. It's not actually like you just need to validate yourself.
Yeah.
With pre-assumed, like you've decided that this is the right one, right? And that's not real either. I do think that there's some psychological benefit to like faking yourself to believing that you are in control. If that's like a big thing that you have, like you need to feel like you're in control. Like there's the famous story of a big artist where they sent in notes and the mix engineer thought the notes were ridiculous. So he just named it the next mix, renamed it, sent in the exact same mix. And then the artist is like, yeah, that's great. And then, so the artist just wanted to feel like they're playing a part in the mix. And you shouldn't necessarily be doing that in bad faith, right? But I mean, like, there's an illusion of control that is important.
I'm not gonna lie to having done that in the past.
Yeah, I've also done that in the past too. Don't do that.
Don't do it out of bad faith. Like sometimes,
or out of spite. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Like sometimes it's a warranted moment where you're like, let me test the waters real quick, and if they come back with the same note, then I will make the change.
Yeah, it's still a little bit more. It's like, all right, that's not permission to do that more often.
Yeah, no, it's a very tricky one. It could go badly so quickly.
Yeah, and when it comes to like plugins and stuff, there's paralysis from too many options and it can ruin momentum. Mm-hmm. So even if like I have we probably both have like 1,000 plugins and I still stick to my favorite 20 to 30. And that 20 or 30 may change at the time, but like my human brain at my IQ level is not able to process or think impulsively with more than 20 to 30 plugins at a time. Like I can't think about the emotional impact if I'm on like loading the processing of thinking, sifting through 1,000 different plugins at any given moment.
So I did a blind test with myself recently. No, I can't say it like that. I did a blind test with 3 people where I took the stems of a show because I record every show that I do front of house for, even if the client doesn't ask, you never know. They might, same thing as in the studio. Did you get that take? Were you recording right there? You know, you never want to be the guy at the show also that everybody knows has the ability to record. And then we're like, oh, I actually didn't record this one. But I had this running theory in my head that like, when I'm working on my console, I get better mixes than when I'm working in Pro Tools, not because the console is better, but because of the limitation of tools. In my console, I don't have FabFilter Pro Q4. In fact, I only have a 4-band EQ with 2 filters, a low filter and a high filter. I have 1 compressor, which I can change between an RMS or a peak, and I have maybe some light gain distortion that I can put onto the preamp. Outside of that, like limiting myself to the basic core functions of the console and using what's available. So if I wanted to run parallel, I'd have to set up a group and then parallel using that same compressor that I have available for any channel. So it's not like I have access to things. But the funny thing is what I found is I paid more attention to what limitations I had available to myself and sculpted based around those limitations. And that felt a little more organic and unified as a mix than having a ton of plugins that I can load in saying like, oh, I wish the kick drum was just a little bit boomier in the lows. So then reaching for Voice of God versus looking for places where I could sculpt more space for the lows. And what's cool is like sometimes this for me was kind of a reminder to go back to minimalist, because I've always explained myself as a minimalist. Like if you've ever been to any of the mixing workshops that we've done at in the mix studios in the past, you know that I've always explained like 2-3 plugins on a channel at most times is it. And you would see that half the mix goes untouched half the time. Reason being is that not everything needs to be touched. And that's an important skill set that we've brought up a bunch of times, where sometimes the best mixers just know the difference between something needing to be processed and something's just not needing it. Sometimes it just needs a little bit of automation, a little bit of panning, a little bit of, leveling, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't always need things. But it was kind of cool to see that everybody agreed that the one that required the least amount of processing came out better. Yeah. Because it just kind of tells you, hey, listen, as much as you like these plugins, if you have a hunch that it's not coming out the way you want it to, I'm not saying delete all your work. I'm not saying go back to square one, but maybe start removing some things, because some decisions might be working against you. And that's where, like we were talking about at the start of the episode, the FabFilter reference, because I know we've all seen these pro mixers on Instagram saying this is how I EQ my vocals. And we see a million points of resonance cuttings and stuff like that. With very minimal broad stroke EQ moves. That's something I have noticed. Broad stroke EQ moves is a very late in career move versus early in career. It's a bunch of narrow moves. I have noticed that. But I'm not saying that doing one or the other shows where you're at. I'm just saying that when confronted with limitation, you find how to work around it. And most times we are not trying to change the mix 100%. Sometimes the artist isn't looking for that. I'm sure most people have heard the classic line of like, can you make it sound more like the rough?
Yeah. And by the way, to put that into perspective, even Jason Joshua, the mixer that is famous for saying, fuck your rough mix. I'm not here to make your rough sound better. I'm here to make hits.
Yeah.
When I confronted him specifically, how do you feel about the rough mix as a reference point? There's video evidence of me asking this at a Mix with the Masters panel. He responded with, no, I still respect the rough mix. Okay, I have a few more talking points that I need to get through.
Let's
so if we're going to keep this episode shorter or reasonable, let's get through them. So number two, what minimalism in mixing actually looks like. Here's the thing. It's not necessarily about using fewer tools, but it's about knowing them deeply. Mm-hmm. Another one that I wrote down is leaning into workflow, fast moves, and gut decisions.
Yes.
Focus on your workflow. Okay. Mm-hmm. I kind of disagree with this, but I think for some people, it's like having go-to chains for vocals, drums, mix bus, etc. I think it's, I don't know if chains is the right word, but like having go-to processing or like having go-to ideas of like, for example, if you really know what a good vocal sounds like, or you understand the context of which this vocal will be placed, then I think you will kind of approach it in a specific manner.
Yeah.
But again, going back to the workflow thing, it's not about the chains. I don't believe in chains. I don't think you should have preset chains. I always use this into this, into this. I don't think that that's a good way of offloading.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
I do think that there is one misconception with it, which is easily showcased. Having a vocal chain is not necessarily bad if it's a starting point, especially in a recording environment. Sometimes the artist just wants to
in a recording environment is different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Recording is different from
but
mixing.
When you have a recording chain with a set EQ that you never change, there is an issue that is inherent, which is key of the song. Sometimes they're singing in one key and you find that one note is a resonant note when they're performing in that one. You save that template.
Not even just the song, dude. The resonance of the vocals.
Exactly.
And the vocal cords, the room, the microphone.
Yeah. As you move around and you go to different spaces, all of it changes.
Yeah.
But the key of the song is probably the most constant change for people. Even if they record from home in the same spot all the time, the key of the song actually makes it to where that resonance will also change. Which means you're no longer EQing the same thing the same way, which is why sometimes vocals don't sound as good out the gate as other times. You know, if you know your vocals well and you tend to always sing in certain keys, cool. Hey, you know, that's great for you. Yeah, this might work out better for you. But for the majority of the time, chains don't always work out because they're usually a fixed situation that worked well once. And then we're hoping you're going to work well with it again the next time.
Yeah. So I think like a great example of what minimalism in mixing, like intentionally being a little bit more minimalistic looks like is I think it's okay if you say something like, hey, I'm going to limit myself, like self-limiting and being like, I'm going to limit my mix bus to 5 plugins max. I'm going to limit my vocals to 5 plugin max. You know,
and
like
that includes your limiter.
Yeah. So it's like just kind of like creating limitations like that is actually like a pretty useful tactic if you need to work with yourself, right?
Yeah.
And again, it's all about trusting instincts over endless tweaking.
Yeah.
Okay, so the third talking point, which is why would you do minimalist approach, or like the benefits of it, is number one, we talk about this often, is speed. Like you're constantly chasing the rabbit down the rabbit hole when it comes to instincts. Instincts and like inspiration is fleeting. Inspiration is always trying to run away from you. And the faster you catch the rabbit, the less likely it's going to get away. Like the faster you act. So like just inspiration is fleeting, so work faster. You're going to be more balanced. You're going to like, it's going to be more instinct based. You're going to be more consistent because you're creating less variables. So it'll be a little bit more consistent. So you're not going to fuck it up as much.
Yeah.
You're less likely to fuck it up just from like a probability and a statistics perspective.
I think it helps. Go ahead. Oh, okay. I was going to say, I think one of my favorite recent mastering gigs that I did was somebody sent me a record that they described as fun. And when I listened to it, it was so fun that I didn't actually hear anything wrong with the mix. So all I did for mastering was load up Ozone to do just small, super small, like almost unrecognizable, like dynamic changes, just like adding a little bit more transient, just because I thought a little more transient would help. And then loading up Invisible Limiter, just doing like a dB or two on it, maybe. Gold Clip, because I could tell that the thing was already clipped anyways coming in. So I used a little bit of the gold thing, but not actually clipping with it. And then L2 is just like a final smoother. I sent it off and they're like, sounds perfect. I'm like, I barely touched that thing.
Nice.
But once again, that's a minimalist mastering. And a lot of people kind of envision mastering to be that. Some people want a little more change. Everybody's a case by case difference, but you'd be surprised. Like a lot of times the most meaningless change is all the change it needs.
And to call everybody out who paused and rewinded the podcast to write down Lou's specific chain, you're missing the point.
Yeah. Yeah. If you did that, like, I'm sorry to tell you, yes, I do like those things, but as much as I like using Ozone here and there, I also don't like using Ozone here and there. And we can talk about that later in DMs if you'd like.
It's about context. We're talking about the importance of context.
Exactly.
So you're missing the point if you think we have some sort of secret sauce. Our secret sauce is we know Marinara. What a good master sounds like, not how we got there in this specific instance.
Yeah.
All right. Another reason why using less tools is good is because it increases your confidence. If you know your tools better, you're going to be a lot more confident.
Yep.
It increases focus, you know, instead of using four compressors to do one. But there's also benefits sometimes to using. We're going to get into the benefits later. Okay. Translatability, fewer heavier chains equals fewer surprises on exports.
Yep.
Okay, when do you add more and when not to? There's a correlation where like people think minimalism is like lazy. No, using less plugins or more plugins is not correlated to value or self-worth, or effort has not correlated to how good the mix sounds. Yeah. Sometimes the mix already sounds good before you even touched anything, and it takes a ton of skill and a lot of self-confidence and a lot of trust in yourself to do very little, because human nature is to correlate effort, time, to value. And that is not the case. Minimalism is not lazy, right? You just have to be, it's intentionality and it's openness to the emotional impact. Like it's being open. I don't know. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself.
No, I got it.
Okay. Adding plugins when there's no defined goal is crazy. Like don't add, like if you don't know, like here's the thing. If you don't know what the vocal should sound like, don't add more. The solution to that isn't more plugins or more moves. At the beginning to intermediate stage, you're guessing a lot. And there's a time and a place to be guessing. But you have to realize that eventually, like, there's a time and a place to sweep and boost 10 dBs of like a high EQ and figure out what frequencies sound bad as sweeping and killing. And then eventually at the higher end of the game, people do that less.
Yeah.
Right? There's not a lot. Like I'm not sweeping for what frequencies do I need to kill. Like I hear them inherently and I kill them.
Yeah.
you know, or if I need to kill at all. And even that context of do I need to kill it is something that is more thoughtful that I do now than would be at the beginning of intermediate stages. Ask, do I need a new tool? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I've always liked the example of like when people go to the gym and they're like, so what are you coming to the gym for? It's like, oh, you know, I just want to be able to like hang out more with my kids or, you know, want to go out with my girlfriend and not feel so tired throughout the day. It's like, oh, cool. And then they immediately go to weight training and I'm like, no, man, you need more cardio. Like you need to be able to like regulate your breathing when moving around more often. And I hate to tell you, but weight training is almost entirely stationary. So unless the goal was to be stationary, you're doing the wrong thing. You're doing too much.
But there's also weight exercises that help with stability muscles that help you run better without injury or help you throw a baseball without injury, right?
But if you just go blindly, you might not be able to get to that goal, you know, because if you're doing bench presses with the goal of increasing your stamina, I mean, maybe increasing your stamina under extreme pressure. I don't know what you're doing outside with your girlfriend that needs that much stamina in your chest, but... Hey, listen, man, do you.
I'm saying that there's like a non-dualist approach. It's not about, because sometimes if you're not going to the gym to begin with, you should be going to the gym. And I'm not going to critique on whether you should be to cardio or specific way. Like, it's good that you're going to the gym and trying things out.
Period.
But if you've been trying things out and if you're trying to, if you have a set goal, eventually you're going to figure out that it's more beneficial to do specific things and you're naturally going to become curious of what should I be doing? Mm-hmm. Right. So we're not here to shame people for not being way too extravagant or overthinking everything and overprocessing. That is a natural, necessary part of eventually we're skipping a point and saying that eventually you're going to learn that it's not about that.
Yeah.
We're not trying to force that prematurely. Like it is a necessary part of the maturation process of mixing to go through realizing, oh, weightlifting didn't help me. But then also realizing weightlifting helped me realize that this was better. Like, so it's like, right?
There's
so
parts we're not of it trying that to get worked, but there's other parts that didn't.
Yeah. Because right now, for some people, you just need to focus on going to the gym.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So ask yourself, do I need a new tool or do I need to use what I have better? Here's another reference quote. Amateurs want more tools. Pros want more clarity.
Okay, so a good example of this is woodworking. This is actually very prevalent in the woodworking community as far as like all these young cats want their track saws and their track guides and their this and that and blah, blah, blah. I just have a hand shank and I just have a hand planer. I don't need an automatic planer. Those things cause more issues, this and that. And what's funny about this, I know a lot of people that are listening to our podcast probably don't do woodworking. I'm just the nerd for that shit. But the reality is it comes back to our fundamentals. If you don't know what you're doing with the basic EQ, you don't need a Pultec. And understanding a Pultec is actually a little more complicated than understanding a basic EQ, even though it only has two knobs on each frequency side. The top end has a width, a frequency, and a boost, and a cut. That's it. In fact, I don't even think the other one has a cut. No, it's separated into two. But point is, if you don't know what you're doing with it, you might find something cool. You know, you might stumble upon something accidentally that's kind of vibey, but you don't actually understand what you're doing. And that just doesn't help you in the long run. So when it comes to the woodworking comparison, a hand planer, you have to be in control of it. You have to know about sharpening the proper tool and knowing how to use it to get a certain end result. It might take a little more work at first, but you might find yourself later in life saying, you know what? Majority of the time, all I need is a hand planer. These automatic ones, they sometimes cause issues. Sometimes they chip off a little too much off of the thing. And if you're going with the RPM set too high, you might be clipping the wood, burning the wood. You might be doing all these things that actually work against you when just going back to the basics of your tools. You don't need a new tool. They might help you smooth out a couple things here and there. But majority of the time, you'll find that, you know what? FabFilter Pro Q3 is totally fine and I don't need Pro Q4. For any of you looking to pay the extra $100, I'm not hating on that FabFilter. Anybody that knows me knows I love FabFilter, but not all of you need the Pro Q4 upgrade.
Yep, that's true. We're going to give me a second here.
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to skip that talking point, actually. Thank you for adding that, Lou. Number my sixth talking point is the emotional creative side of minimalism mixing. Mm-hmm. Again, this is a big, big part of it. We're re-emphasizing this often and often making its own episode because you need letting go of insecurity. If you think it's not perfect yet, your natural reaction shouldn't be, let's add more.
Yeah.
It's not perfect yet is a normal thing to feel.
Mm-hmm.
Your reaction to that, you should be mindful and realize that the natural reaction, that it is counterintuitive to say, thus I must add more. Again, there is no correlation to effort or doing more to how good a mix will come out.
Yeah.
There is no correlation. And it takes it doesn't even take high self-esteem. It takes awareness of realizing how you're making up for your insecurities. Like becoming mindful of where you're insecure and how you make up for those insecurities. And again, I think the natural human instinct is, oh, I must not be good enough. I should be doing more because the people on YouTube do more. It's wrong. That's wrong. It's not correlated. Not good. If anything, it's working against you. You have to, at a certain degree, it's not about being good. It's about trusting your taste.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think it's like minimal mixing equals maximal intention. Becoming, using your intention, trusting your taste. Like there's a reason why there are some mixes floating out there that have won awards that are just very, very stimulating or like emotionally connecting or just objectively, metrically has sold more records. That was mixed by the artist who is not a mixer, who mixed incorrectly by all YouTube rules and laws set forth by the YouTube gods and algorithms and influencers, right? But they were so connected to the emotional integrity of the song that even if they had zero skills or technical understanding of how a mix works, the song still bangs.
Yeah.
It's about intention and vision and knowing what you want. Artists are paying you for your vision and intention. They're not paying you for the number of tools you have or how you use them.
Yeah. You know, there was something that, what's his name? Dale Becker, I think his name is.
Yeah, the mastering engineer.
Yeah. So I don't know him personally. I think we've ran into each other like once in passing. He did a master to a song that I was asked to do a rush master for. And I guess the reason they didn't send it back to him in my head, the only way I can make sense of that decision was they needed it like that night and maybe he was too busy. But he had previously done a master to a version that had a different verse from a different artist on it. And I was asked to do as close to a one-to-one equal master to it. And you know what? Maybe this works against me, but hey, the reality is I wasn't able to match it. There was something on it. I've heard everybody under the sun critique everybody under the sun. So I know that there's some people who think of Dale as like an amazing mastering engineer. Some people say he's run out of the gun. Listen, man, in that moment, that's the first time I ever heard one of my masters versus one of his masters and using his as a reference point that I could actually say, I don't know what the fuck voodoo he did, but it didn't sound like he changed the master, but yet the master sounded better. And no matter how minimalist I went, no matter how many plugins I threw at it, no matter anything that I did, I couldn't exactly recreate without having to admit defeat and just going up to the guy and saying, dude, what did you do? And to be honest, he hasn't even responded to my message. I just DM'd him on Instagram. I probably went to the fucking request bin. I could give a shit about that. Point is, expertise ultimately is the reason why some people are arguably doing well and have good end results. It's not the tools, because no matter how many tools I have, no matter how little I put on it, it's whatever was running through his mind in that moment that made the decisions. It wasn't Pro Q3. It wasn't Pro Q4. It wasn't the Acoustica stuff that I have. It's not any of that. He just did something magical. And the funny thing is, if you really want to know about minimalist work, a good idea is to reach out to mastering engineers, because a lot of mastering engineers are minimalist by nature. They're not trying to over tweak anything because they're not trying to revolutionize the mix that another mixing engineer has been paid a premium for. And usually once you get to a certain scale, like RCA is the one that wanted me to do this master, you know, so I'm over here competing with other label mastering engineers, and most times I've won, but in this case, I had to give it to him. I told the artist, I'm like, listen, man, I know he's not available right now or whatever the situation is, but I'm not going to be able to give you a one-to-one. And I don't know what he did because it doesn't sound like he did much, but there's something good about it. And I don't know what it is, but I'm not going to try to overprocess trying to achieve the same good because all I'm doing is going against the grain in a way that I don't think is benefiting the record. We ended up going with a cleaner master. But flowers to Dale. Dale, I don't know what he did, but he did a good job on that one. And it didn't even sound like he did anything. And I think that's where minimalism kind of shows itself in a graceful light. When you can do something without making it sound like you revolutionized the wheel, and it still sounds like you revolutionized the wheel.
Incredible. That's a good story. That's a great, that's a great story.
Yeah.
So I think on closing, a couple closing thoughts and talking points here is minimalism isn't about rules. It's about clarity. So like to say like to self-limit and self-impose limiting rules is kind of getting there, but it's still missing the exact point, which is it's the opposite of rules. It's about instincts. It's about doing what's best for the song. It's about clarity. It's about intention. Mm-hmm. So minimalism isn't about rules. It's about clarity. A minimalist doesn't use fewer tools. They use fewer excuses.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty tough one.
Yeah.
That's a pretty tough one. Here's something that we should ask you. What's the smallest plugin chain you've ever used for a full mix? Let us know in the Discord or tag us on Instagram, DM us on Instagram. Like, what's the smallest plugin chain you've ever used for a full mix? How many?
Just to be clear, the
smallest
the answer
number
cannot
of plugins.
Be, yeah, we're asking for the smallest number of plugins. The number can't be zero. It could be one, but if you say zero, I'm sure there's a lot of people who have said zero when it comes to a specific source, but we're just asking in general. What's the least amount you've had to pull up to get where you wanted to go, not if you never needed something.
Yeah.
Ooh,
I just thought of a counterexample too. Sometimes we feel so confident and we build up an ego that we receive a mix that sounds good by someone that we subconsciously perceive as lower ranked.
Yes.
And then we can't fathom, like, we must be better than them, so we must make changes. So now it's like those changes are ego-based. Be careful of that, too. Like, mm-hmm. Don't think in vertical hierarchies. Try to remove yourself from vertical hierarchies. Yeah. People are people, and sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, and it has nothing to do with your self-perceived vertical hierarchies. There's no such thing as vertical hierarchies. People are just different. So don't also feel so confident. Be wary of being so overconfident that it starts feeding the ego.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's humble and safe to admit that they did a great job, even if they're significantly less experienced than you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to add that. That was a friend of mine from a recent experience of mine. So, that's it for this episode. If you want more technical episodes of the podcast, we've got a lot of new Patreon subscribers.
Hell yeah.
So I want to do a little shout out. I should have done this at the beginning. I apologize, but we have a lot of new members. Let me pull up the members list of people that are currently active members of the podcast. Oops, I'm pressing the wrong thing. While we find that, Lou, tell us about, shut up. I found it. I found it. All right, Luis Hernandez, Justin Jimenez, Raschi Le Black Edge, Tyler Ming, Feli Landville, Daniel Picora, Tyler Ming, Feli Landville, Daniel Picora, Caleb, Christian Ellis, Jared Barnum, Flock, Sivanyanik, oh my gosh. Schultz.
I apologize for Dominic's pronunciation.
Dominic Flugel, Elias Lamb, Adio, Terrell. Oh, there you go. Jason Parsley, Mighty Made Fellows, thanks for being part of our Patreon. And yeah, there's 250 plus episodes that are already out that you get added to on top of the regular episodes, the free episodes that come out. So go check those out. They're all technical, shorter technical episodes with me and James. Also, there's a free tier of our Patreon where you get access to some free downloadable PDFs as well. So go check that out. Just go join our Patreon for free too, or you get free stuff. So that's mixingmusicpodcast.com/Patreon. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Love to travel? Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
You already love the Mixing Music Podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today.